Okay, so let me first thank the organizers for the very kind invitation to be here. So in this very nice place. So the talk I'm going to give you is a little bit off stream because I'm going to talk about problems which are motivated by neuroscience. But I think it's not totally legitimate that in a meeting which is called memory formation that there is a talk about neuroscience. And then, as you will see, actually, most of the work is actually really, I think, pure statistical physics. And I hope you will find this statistical physics problem interesting. So this work has been done in collaboration with Simona Coco and Lorenzo Posani, who are both at the ENS Paris. So Lorenzo is doing his PhD. And we have also some input from Kyle Jezek, who is an experimentalist. And you will see the data we used. We were actually recorded by Kyle. And he's working in Pilsen in the Czech Republic. And Sophie Rosel, who is a former PhD student who is a postdoc in Trieste in Italy. Okay, so what I am interested in is how space is represented in the brain and how actually different representation of space change dynamically. So this is actually a collective problem, which is interesting, I think. And there have been a lot of experimental progress in the past decades about this problem, which actually now make the need for modeling more and more pressing. So where are the interesting things taking place? So here is the, okay, that's it. So here is a drawing of the rat brain. All experiments I'm going to talk about are done in rats, but actually there are also essentially, I think all the results are essentially valid for all mammals. And there are also experiments in monkeys, in bats, which are quite interesting that we'll maybe talk a little bit about at the end if I have time. So there is one particular region in the brain which is called the hippocampus. And the hippocampus has been known for a very long time to be a fundamental region for memory formation. So people with lesions in the hippocampus are unable to form new memories, but are totally able to recall all memories, which are stored in other regions. So just to give you an idea, this hippocampus has about 300,000 neurons in rats, and there are two orders of magnitude more in humans. And they are present in all vertebrates, so to be clear, they are present in all mammals. So it's really a mammalian brain area, but there are some kind of equivalent or let's say evolutionary related brain areas in all vertebrates, like as in fish, for instance. So a major discovery was done at the beginning of the 70s by John O'Keefe, and he got the Nobel Prize in 2014 for this fundamental discovery. And the fundamental discovery that when an electrode is inserted inside the hippocampus, then the activity of neurons that you can recall from the electrode is actually correlated with the position of the animal in space. And the corresponding neurons are called place cells. So just to be a little bit more clear, so here you see, for instance, an environment, which is a circular arena. A rat is moving. At the same time, you can record the activity. I will show you a movie in a couple of seconds. You can record the activity, and then you will see that a particular neuron will be active only when the rat is somewhere here. Another neuron will be active only here. So this neuron encode information about the position of the organisms in the environment. They're called place cells, and the set of positions where they are active are called place field. So let me show you a movie, which actually I just took yesterday evening, on the internet. So it's a movie coming from the, is it opening? Should open. Maybe. So it's a movie you can find on YouTube, and you can find many other movies. And it comes from the Matthew Wilson lab at MIT. So okay, let me stop it. So what you see is a view from the top of 1D environment, which is actually some kind of ring. So the rat is here at the beginning, and then it moves along the ring, okay? So you can see the animal here. And the animal has some electrodes implanted on the skull, and actually which record the activity of a tiny portion of the hippocampus. So on the right, you see the animal moving. On the left, you see something that's not the raw data, that's the data after processing, spike sorting, so that the different electrodes, which are picked up by the electrodes, are identified from 1 to 10. There are 10 recorded electrodes here. Each one is given a particular color so that you can identify them easily. And each time they are active, so they emit a spike, so this action potential, which is very localized in time, about some milliseconds, then you see a bar. That's called a raster plot. So let me play the movie so you can see this place cells. And each time a neuron emits a spike, then a dot with the corresponding color is placed here, exactly at the position of a head. So you see a sequence of different colors, and all the neurons fire, okay, and they have place fields, which are bigger or smaller, depending on the neurons, and that correspond to different places along the location along the maze, okay? So if you look carefully, if you look carefully at the movie, when the rat is immobile at the end of the trajectory, something interesting happens. So you get the sequence of place cells, but then at the end, you will see that very briefly, on a very short time scale, all the place cells will become active, so the rat is immobile. So it's a very fundamental fact. I will come back to that. Okay, you see here, you will see very quickly that sequence of activation. They all pair together, but the rat is not moving. Okay. Yes? Okay, so when you put a rat in an environment, it will take about 10 minutes, 20 minutes to stabilize this place field. And then in practice, then if you put the rat again the day after, a week after, and so on, then you should find exactly the same position for the same cells. What is hard, actually, is to keep the same cell recorded so that the electrode doesn't move. But that is interesting. Now, actually, a study is very interesting to this about what happens in all rats. And you see they have actually a hard time to memorize new environments. Anyway, so there are a lot of interesting, there are hundreds, thousands of papers about these place cells, so, but I want to mention just a few of them because I think they are relevant for my talk today. So these place fields are achieved when the animal is placed in the same environment, as I said, after days. They are stable in the dark, that is, even if you don't have any visual inputs, then the rat is able, you will see the same kind of activation pattern. So it's not only visual inputs which are, short and integrated by the brain, it's much more complicated. And they do not depend only on position, they depend also on what people call context. So I will show you two experiments where you can see that.
When she starts walking from some other place and going back to the place field, it's the same neuron?
It's the same neurons which will fire.
It's not the path.
No, it's not the path, that's the position. But actually, some things which are not related to position may be encoded, and this is an example in this experiment from 2006 by Mizumori and collaborators. So you have a cross maze, and what the rat has to do is to go from one of the extremities here to the east arm, where some reward is found, that is food or water, for instance. And this is for 10 trials, so the first 10 trials, the rat learns to do that, and the next 10 trials, the reward is not in the east arm, it's in the west arm. So the maze has not changed, but the task has changed. So 10 trials east, 10 trials west. And what you see, do that, so you have different place cells here, which are recorded. You see, for instance, this place cell here, and you can look at the place field during the first 10 trials, which is quite stable. Then it will fire when the rat is essentially in the center here of the maze. But then in the next 10 trials, it will fire somewhere else. So in between the 10th and the 11th trial, the place field has changed. And then it's stable for 10 trials more. Okay?
It's the same cell.
It's the same cell. So it's coding for position, but not in the same way, because the task has changed. So that means that there is a different representation of space, which depends on the task to be done. So I'm showing you another experiment where the same thing is seen. So here you have an experiment when the rat is actually walking on a plate here, this disc, and this disc is rotating at a fixed angular velocity. And there is a blue zone here where the rat gets an electric shock if the rat is sitting there, okay? So that is a zone that the rat tries to avoid. But there is also another zone, which is the red one, which is fixed in the room environment, in the room referential, if you want, which is also a bad zone, where the rat can get another electric shock. So you have these two zones, one is rotating, another one is fixed, that the rat should avoid. So if you look at place cells, you find two kinds, two populations of place cells. Some of them are their place fields, which are fixed in the room environment, and other ones are rotating at the same angular velocity as the disk. Okay, so the rat is maintaining two different maps of the environment, one rotating, and it's very nice to have this one because you can locate the blue zone very easily, and one fixed, and it's nice because you want also to locate the red zone. Okay, so it's very important to do that. So you can see these things here. And now, which map is actually activated at any given time depends on the distance to the closest zone. And this is seen here. So on the bottom panel, so there are four different repetitions of the experiments. On the bottom panel, you get here some kind of order parameter, which is red and positive when the rat is activating the place cells whose place fields are fixed in the room environment. And blue is it's activating the other place cells. And you see that this is fluctuating over time, and this is strongly correlated to the two distances to the two zones. And actually, the closest distance tells you which map is retrieved. So that means that there are different kinds of representation of space in the brain, and they are retrieved depending on the functional need, the one which are most convenient for the behavior to take decisions. Yes? Yes. Exactly. Exactly. So the memory are two different, you know, contexts here. One is the rotating one, one the other one is the fixed one. But it had to keep track of these things here, keep track of the position in the both in both representation, and then evoke one or the other depending on the functional needs. Okay. So how can you do that? That's I tell you that's my so. Yes, that it will have another representation. Another representation. Okay, so, and then the last thing I would like to show, and actually that's something you have already seen in the in Matt Wilson movie, is that if you take a rat moving along a 1D maze or even in 2D that doesn't change anything, then you have the, during the physical motion here of the rat, then you see the sequence of place cells activating one after the other depending on the position in space. But when the rat is immobile, you see the same sequence of activation on a much, much smaller time scale. Okay? So time scale here for physical motion is about 1 second to go from one place to the other, a few seconds. And here it's just 100 milliseconds or 150 milliseconds. That means that the activity of this these place cells can be driven by, you know, inputs, but it can be also set generated by a network. So, and this is my main question here I would like to talk about is how are all these multiple maps and representations and how positions are encoded in the hypercamper neural network. Because at the end of the game, we have a single hypercamper, well, two of them on both hemispheres, but that should encode all these representations, all these memories, and that should be dynamically retrieved at any time depending on what is going on. So I will do some, let's say, first, tell you about data analysis, the kind of the experiment we analyzed, the kind of things we find, and then the model, which is really based on some ideas from statistical physics. And then I will go back to data because the model makes some precise prediction that we can test with the data. Okay, so the experiment we looked at is an experiment done by the Moser and Moser group. So the Moser and Moser are actually the two other awardees of the Nobel Prize in 2014. For the discovery of grid cells, I will talk briefly about, because I need them in a few slides. And they did this experiment, which is called a teleportation experiment. It works in the following way. So you have multi-electrodes implanted in the hippocampus, and we have activities about 34 neurons for about 20 minutes. That's time scale, essentially. And at any time, in a small timing of, let's say, 100 milliseconds, we have the activity of 34 neurons, and the activity will be essentially modeled here as by one if a neuron is active or zero if it's silent. So the time scale, why this time scale is relevant, I'll talk about that later. Okay, so so the experiment is done in two different phases. The first one is training. So this is the training phase. There are two boxes. The boxes are absolutely identical in shape and size, and they are connected by a corridor. So this drawing is actually not very good. The size, the linear size here is 60 centimeters in reality, and the corridor is long, it's 2 meters long. And the only difference between the two boxes are the light condition. You have a dim light on the top of a box here, and you have also dim light on the side of the box here. So they're not the same lights, okay? Apart from that, it's exactly the same thing. And you let the rat go in this environment. The rat has nothing to do but wander in the environment. And if you do that after some time, what you see is that one particular cell among the 30 and something will have a place field here in box A and a place field here in box B. And this is very similar to what I said before, okay? I mean, these place cells is calling for positions. The two boxes, though they are identical in shape, they are clearly different. They are not the same physical environment, so the place cell will fire, will be active in different places. Now comes the interesting part of the experiment, which is the test phase. Now we have a single box, again identical in shape and size to the previous one, with a switch, so that you can switch the light instantaneously and go from the light condition of box A to light condition of box B immediately. And then you can see how the activity recording in the hippocampus changes. So that's what these people call teleportation. Well, no, I'll talk about virtual reality later, but that's real, okay? Okay, so we have this data. So first of all, we'd like to do two things. We'd like to decode the activity and see what is the brain state? What kind of map is loaded as a function of time? Is it the map of box A or the map of box B?
Question.
Yes?
So the lights are changing, but the corridors are placed in different locations in the two boxes, so the rat knows which box it is in. You're not showing the corridor, but the corridor.
There is no corridor here. It's a single box in the test phase. Yeah, so you have corridors during the training session. In the test phase, you have a single box. Okay, so what we'd like to do first is to identify the brain state. So is the rat at time t in a mental state which corresponds to box A or to box B? So it's a lab rat. It doesn't have a very rich life. It knows box A, box B, and maybe another box somewhere, and that's it. For a normal rat with a very interesting life, that there could be many other states, okay? But here, that's it. Okay, so to do that, so we do some statistical inference, so using the Ising model, so I will tell you how that works. So essentially, what we have our data, so at time t, we have the configuration of activity, and from this configuration of activity, we would like to know whether this is A or B. So how do we do that? It's simple. We will build two models based on the training sessions. So during this training session, when the rat is in A or when the rat is in B, we have some samples of activity. So we can build a model for the activity when the rat is in A, another model when the rat is in B. Then when we have a single configuration of activity, we can compare to the two models. One of the two models will have a higher probability than the other one, and from that we can decode whether we are in A or B. That's a very simple decoding procedure. Now the question is, what kind of model should we use? So the model we use is an Ising model. We could use other models, but the Ising model is a natural one. And why is it a natural one? Because you see, what is the main difference between box A and box B? Well, you have the same cells, but they are not active at the same place. In particular, the pairwise correlation of the cells is completely different in environment A or B. So for instance, if you look at these orange and green cells, they may have overlapping fields in box A, but they may be very far away in box B. So you will never find them active together in box B, but they will be active in box A sometimes. So now if you look at your activity configuration, if you see that both of them are active, it's very likely you are in A and not in B. Okay, that's the idea. So the pattern of pairwise correlation is actually very useful to do the decoding of states. And this can be captured in the Ising model, where the SI tells you whether it's one if the neuron is active in the time being, or zero if it's not active. So we fit these parameters, which reproduce the mean activity of each cell and the pairwise correlation of all pairs of cells here with these parameters. So there are some techniques to do that, which were actually evoked by Arup Chakraborty earlier in the week. And then so we get the two probabilities here, and if we take the log of the ratio of the two probabilities, it's a variation of log likelihood, and this is what you get during the reference session. You see, for instance, when you are in A, then you find that this delta L is positive, almost at all times. When you are in B, it's almost always negative. Okay, so it's a very strong indication of the mental state. So M is A or B. It's box A or box B. So you have two models for the two possibilities. And now you can score any configuration of activity according to the two models. One with high probability, the other one low. And you say, OK, that's this one. It's a hidden variable. So that's A or B you want to decode. And S is the activity configuration. Yes? Yeah, you can do a naive Bayesian decoder.
How different is
it? No, okay, so it depends on where you record, so it's getting technical. It depends on the area in the brain where you record, in the hippocampus. So in CA3.
Are you very different from a Fisher discriminant or comparable Fisher discriminant?
Okay, so. So we compare to other classifiers that people use in computational neuroscience.
But not to Fisher.
Not to Fisher. Okay.
Because I always find that people never present that, but that's the simplest thing.
Well, I mean, we have a linear classifier it's a kind of linear classifier if you use independent cells model. So maybe it's very similar to what you are saying. And the performances are worse. Okay, I can show you a curse if you want. Okay. Yes. Well, it depends on the region. In CA3, maybe it's a 10%. If you are in CA1, it's a huge difference. Because the activity is more or less the same on average. But I mean, the big difference is in the pattern of pairwise correlation. Okay, so you have a histogram in box B, another histogram in box A, and you see they don't overlap much, so it should be a good decoder of these states. So let's use it on the test session here, and this is what you get. This is an example of the data. So here you have time in units of, let's say, 125 milliseconds. Which is this time scale, which is important. I'll talk about that later on. And here you see delta L as a function of time. So when you see voids here, it means simply that no neurons were active. So we could decode, but it's very unreliable. So on. And you see, okay, so what you see here, this red line, is the time at which the switch was done. So before this time here, clearly delta L is negative. That means the rat was in box B mentally. Then there is a switch, it goes to A, but you see B, A, B, A, and sometimes a little bit of B, and so on. And then it stabilizes. So we have some oscillation here for a few seconds, okay, and then we get stability. Now, if you repeat these experiments many times, and we have 16 repetitions in the data set, it seems that these oscillations get less and less frequent as you move away from the switch, okay. So it's kind of very unstable right after the switch, and then it becomes stable. And so it was reported in the experimental paper that there is an exponential decay with the probability of this switch, of this oscillation when you move away from the switch time. And then there is this instability period for a few seconds. OK, is it OK for yes? Yeah, sure. No. Some of them are active only in one environment, or the one are active in the other environment. There is a fraction of that.
And this would work as well because the fraction
was high
enough.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if the fraction is very low, it is very good because there are orthogonal maps and it's very easy to decode. Okay, so this is a brain state, but there is more information than being A on B. There is information about where the rat is. So we can decode position from the activity. And so we use a very simple decoder for position here. So essentially, as the idea is very simple, you have this place field that tells you where a cell is active, okay? And essentially, it tells you a bit more than that. It tells you the probability that a cell is active given the position x of the animal. Now you can use a very simple naive Bayesian decoder when you just say, okay, my probability of my configuration of the n cells is just the product of the probabilities of the all cells. So I don't know the position of the animal, but I know all the activities here, 0, 1, for each cell I at time t. And then, okay, if I know this thing, I can optimize the x, and it will give me the most likely position of the animal. Okay? If you do that, and people have been doing that for a long time, then it works really well. So it's just, you know, in a normal situation where you have a single environment, the rat is moving. So here, for instance, is an example where you have the coordinate x and y as a function of time, and the true position is in red, and the position you infer with this decoding technique is the blue one. So you see there is obviously some mistakes because maybe just before, because the recording is, you know, the sampling is random, so there may be positions in space which are not covered by many place fields, so there are the mistakes, the error will be high. But typically it works well. So what happens if we apply this decoder of position on the experimental data where the representation changes a lot? So here is what happened, is going on. So this is x and y as a function of time, and we use the place fields corresponding to the light condition. So this is A here, and then it becomes B, so we use the place field of A here, and after the switch, B. So you see here, it's really good, the trajectory, the true one and the inferred one are close, but then it becomes a disaster. And here is the error between the true position and the inferred position. Okay, so that doesn't work. And why it cannot work? It doesn't work because actually the representation is changing. We should not use the representation, the maps corresponding to the external light, but we should use the representation decoded by our decoder. So if you want, here what I have done, I have shown so far, is we can decode the map here, and the map which is decoded, we should use for the position decoder. So that means that if I want to use the language of that Eric talked about yesterday in his talk, we have two different possible syntaxes, okay? We have map A or map B, and then there is this kind of semantical information, which is the position. And if we want to understand what is going on, we have to use the right language at the right time. Otherwise, it would be a disaster. Yes? Yes.
So presumably it couldn't be that you know when the mouse is in this environment it basically has multiple you know it has multiple decoders running in parallel.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so when something happens then it starts from which should I trust more and there's sort of conflicting kind of information and that gives rise to this.
Yes, I talk about that. I fully agree.
Okay.
But here I'm just doing data analysis. I just want to see whether actually the position is encoded. So what I see is that the way the kind of representation is changing very quickly, I want to know whether position is encoded in the right way at any time. That's just the data analysis question. So we can use the decoded representation, the inferred map, to decode the position. And if you do that, you see that now after the switch, the position is really good too. The error has decreased a lot. In fact, you can do statistics about that. And the error you find on the decoded position is the same as in typical experiments when there is no light switch, normal, you know, single environment motion. So that means that though the language, if you want, is changing very quickly, the way position is encoding is accurate at any time. So it's an interesting property. And the question was, so let me say it here in a different way. Here are the data. You see the neuron spiking. Here is the physical trajectory that you see in space. And this physical trajectory can be encoded in terms of neural activity in two ways, depending on whether it's in box A or in box B. Okay? So the neural code is changing very quickly on a few tens of milliseconds time scale. But anyway, it just expresses the position with high accuracy at any time. So how is it possible to do that? I mean, there is a hypercompound network which is able to achieve that. So how does that work? So this is where the modeling part comes in. And I would like to tell you what we have done in terms of theory. Okay, so the problem here is that I have cheated in the sense that I have used two different decoders to decode the maps. This is fine. I can do that, obviously. But of course, physically or biologically, there is a single neural network which is able to express these two maps and the position. So I should have a single model. I cannot use two models. That's not good. So what kind of model should I use? So we can draw our inspiration from the inferred couplings. So here I plot, for instance, in map A, the couplings between the cells as a function of the distance between the place field. And you see, this is obviously very noisy, but if you do some kind of flying average, you see it's positive and decreasing at short distances, And then it becomes slightly negative at long distances. So it's very similar to what we expect in lattice gas model, for instance, okay, where you may have attractive couplings at short distances and negative couplings at longer distances. Okay. So in fact, there is a deep connection with the lattice gas models I'm coming to. So the idea is the following. So here is the physical space. Here are two neurons in the hypocampal network, the green and the orange one, and they have place fields. There is a certain distance between the place fields, and I will assume that the coupling between the neurons is a function of the distance. It's strong or positive at short distances, and it's essentially negative and independent of distance at large distances. That's my assumption. And of course, I have many place fields. I don't have two of them. I have many neurons, so I can draw some graph here, which is essentially some kind of adjacency matrix of the place fields, right? So I and J is the interaction between neuron I and neuron J. But it turns out that this neuron, okay, they have, you know, they correspond to physical position in space. They have some place fields. So if you have a single space, here I'm talking back to the case of a single space, it's well defined. Each neuron will correspond to some position, right? So I will write a coupling which depends on the distance between the two neurons. Yes. Yes, as is known from experiments. Yeah. Okay, so this is the thing. But of course, here I've drawn this nice drawing here, but the position of the neurons in the hypocampal network have nothing to do with the physical positions. Absolutely nothing to do, right? So in fact, the network is something like that. Same links, but completely reshuffled. And this is why it's not so easy experimentally, because when people put an electrode here, well, they pick up some neurons, maybe close to the tip of the electrode, and the place fields are scattered all over the place. Okay? So there is absolutely no relation between distance and position here and here. The only relation is indirect through the existence of connections. So now, what is the distribution of neural activity configuration once you have this network? So something we can do, well, let's try to do something which is somewhat plausible from a biological point of view. So suppose you have a configuration of activity here of 0, 1 for the variables in the time being. So what's the rate of going from one configuration where neuron I is silent to a configuration where it's active? I will use this expression for the rate. And this comes from what a neuron does in practice. A neuron does spatial integration. So that means at any time, a neuron just receives some input from the other neurons, do some kind of combination, some summation, depending on synaptic coefficients, which is the strength of the connection, compared to some threshold, and then will be active or inactive. So the rate of going from one configuration to this one will be the summation of the inputs minus the threshold here, and I divide by some temperature, which is actually the level of neural noise. If this temperature is very small, that means that the neuron will be deterministic. If it's very low, if it's very high here, the neuron will be fully random. Okay. So this is the dynamics. But of course, we know that this dynamics, we have chosen it, so it's plausible to some extent, but it obeys detailed balance, so if you wait long enough, we'll converge to this probability here. Okay? And we recognize exactly an Ising model with some couplings which depends on the distance between the place fields and some negative fields which repress the global magnetization. But this model was introduced a long time ago. In fact, it's exactly the model that Leibovitz and Perrin-Ross considered more than 50 years ago when they were interested in the liquid-vapor transition. So here you have a lattice gas. You put a bunch of particles. The number of particles is fixed. And you have some kind of discrete potential which mimics the Lennard-Jones potential. So you cannot put two particles on the same site. If two particles are next to each other, then they will be attracted. Okay? So you put a positive couplings. And if they are far away, you put zero couplings. So you have a couplings which depends on the distance. Sorry. You have a couplings which depends on the distance between the between the sites. And this model, when you do the study the statistical mechanics of this model, you find two different phases. One gaseous phase at high temperature, where the other parameter, which is the density of particles over space is essentially uniform. So that means the activity of neurons, in my case, does not depend on neurons. They all fire more or less in the same way. At low temperature, you get a bump of particles which are clustered together, and that corresponds to a set of neurons which are strongly interacting, and they all fire together. But of course, the interesting thing here is that this bump can be moved. It's a zero mode in the Hamiltonian here, so you can move it as you want in space, because all these interactions here are invariant under translation, right? So you can move it in space. So this is a very basic principle. In fact, decades after this kind of models in physics, people in computational neuroscience use this principle, and they call it continuous attractor. And this principle is very important for population coding. So the idea is that though the population of neurons is extremely noisy, they achieve some kind of collective state of activity, which is this bump. And you can actually describe this collective state only by the location of a bump, which corresponds to the position in space you want to code for. So the natural collective coordinates of this of collective state is the position, is the thing you want to memorize, position. So you may have two points of view. Either you are looking at the whole population of neurons at any time, and maybe at time A, you will see that the bump is here. Suppose it's a 1D ring here, very simple geometry. So the bump is here, and maybe at time B, later on, it will be here. Okay, and you can see the collective states. Or you can have a different point of view, which is I fix a neuron with my electrode, I measure its activity, and then this is neuron here, and then there are two possibilities. Either the bump is just right on top of it, it will be active, or it's not on top of it, and it will be silent. And this is exactly what people do in experiments, because they see the place field, they measure single neuron, and as a function of a collective coordinate, which is the position of the rat. Okay? Is it? So this is this. Yeah, I'm assuming this, yes. There is no direct evidence of that.
Right. So how, is there any experimental data suggesting that that will produce such a...
In vivo experiments, no. I'm not aware of anything like that. But there are more and more details about the anatomical connections. There was a paper in Science 1.5 years ago. You know, people are now getting more and more information about that.
That anatomy will not do it for you, because what you're asking is something that people have to learn from the...
Yes, I agree. I agree. Well, okay. Translation invariance is an idealized version here.
Approximate,
yes.
Even in the visual system, it's not the case. These deep networks, if they're making these convolutional networks, the visual system actually, you don't have a filter which is being translated in space. They're actually different filters. Then they resemble each other.
Yeah.
But they're not actually the same filter with that same line of shape. It never happens.
Yes, I understand. But I'm not saying that there is a single, it's not a fit-for-one architecture here. I'm not saying that there is a neuron saying all of them. That it's a different architecture. It's not a deep network. Mm-hmm. There is nothing deep here.
The system will self-organize into this XM-XG.
Yeah, OK. So, but I mean, I understand that. But this theory, I mean, that's what people use. And you know, it's you can see that there is some agreement with the data. OK, so now that was a simple situation. Now, what is going on when you have multiple maps? Then the situation is something that people have not looked at in physics, because in principle in physics you have a single space, right? But here it's interesting. So it goes beyond what has been done in physics. So suppose you have an environment one, so I can code for the topology of the environment, the adjacency matrix in environment one, that gives a matrix here. But then there is another map, which has another matrix, that's the same neurons, and then the third one and so on. And then if we use, again, this idea of Hebbian learning, you can imagine that all these connections which are learned just are piled on top of each other and built a single connection matrix here, GIJ. And this idea is exactly the idea that John Hofield had 35 years ago in his famous model, except that the GIJ considered were much simpler. They were rank one matrices, because that was just projection matrices on a single configuration of activity. So his attractors were configuration of activity. They were not continuous manifolds. So the GIJ for Hofield was a Xi-I, Xi-J, where Xi-I was the configuration of activity. So that makes a big difference. Otherwise, the idea is the same. So it's an extension of the Hofield model to D-dimensional attractors.
And the fact that the GIJs are symmetric and INJ, that was considered to be not true.
Well, I mean, physiologically, it's not true.
Yeah.
So actually, it's not completely crazy thing. But as you know, for the Hofi model, if you lift these things, you can do a lot of numerics, and you see essentially that nothing changes.
Right.
So my claim is the same thing here. OK, so the phase diagram of this model we studied with Sophie some years ago. And in fact, it's a phase diagram which is similar to the Hofield phase diagram. So here you have the number of maps divided by the number of neurons. Here you have the neural noise. And if you don't have so many maps and you don't have so much noise, then there is a phase here where the activity can be coherent in one environment, in one map. It's totally incoherent in the other ones. So, and that, I can show you a simulation here where you have two different maps. It's a 1D ring. So what you see is space here along the, so you have 1,000 neurons in this simulation. And I'm just, and here you have time. So you have, let's say, 5,000 configuration during this Monte Carlo simulation. I'm just plotting the activity configuration, which is a string of 1 or 0, according to the position of the place fields in environment 1 here on the left side, and according to the position in environment 2 here. OK, so it's, they are the same data, but there is a permutation of a site here, which corresponds to the fact that I am ordering from the left to right the place field along the ring in environment A1, and here it's done in environment 2. So I'm looking in two different ways at the same data. There is a single hypercompound network, but there are different ways of interpreting the activity. So the fundamental idea is this one. So what you see is that at small times, you see a very dark region here. That means you get the bump of activity, which is coherent in environment 2, but it's totally random in environment 1. You don't see anything here. It's just noisy. But then at some point, it jumps to the other one, environment 1. Then it jumps back to 2, and then it goes to 1. Then it, you know, diffusing is 1, and then goes back to 2, and so on. OK. So. We can understand this kind of spontaneous jumps here, which is actually an activity process. It can be understood with the ideas that Jim Langer put forward many years ago, 50 years ago. So you have activation processes, and there are different scenarios for that. But now the question is, what happens when you have inputs? Because if we believe in this model, now the question is, the rat is seeing some light. The rat is actually have internal inputs I'm going to talk about. And this input should drive the bump of activity. It's not just spontaneous diffusion, right? So essentially, what I'm seeing here is that there is a kind of effective two-continuous state model. So it's a sophisticated two-state model, because this well here corresponds to one manifold, this one to another one. And I can have the activity which is localized in A and random scattered in B, or the other thing here. There is some kind of mixed state, which is the activity state in between, so everything is random. And the question is, I can actually have deeper wells on one side or the other if I have inputs which favor one state or the other. So how does that work? So how do we know about the inputs? So there have been some work which are very interesting recently, where people do experiments in virtual reality. So there are many different kinds of inputs. But the problem is that they all concur together. So they all combine together. It's very hard to distinguish, to disentangle all the inputs. So virtual reality is very interesting for that. So what you have here is a rat moving on a ball. And the number of turns of the ball is just integrated. And that corresponds to a physical motion along a 1D track. And the movie is shown exactly at the same speed. So it's coherent. But then, of course, since it's virtual reality, you can actually play the movie twice faster than the motion, twice slower. Okay, slower. And then that means that the inputs which correspond to visual inputs and the inputs which correspond to integration of motion, then they become, you know, different. And they become incompatible. So what is going on is you can look at the place field, and you see that some cells have place fields which actually are only essentially based on the visual input. They don't care about the motion of the legs. But other cells compute only the motion of the legs, and the place fields correspond to the physical motion of the legs, but they don't care about what is going on the screen. So clearly, the different place cells integrate different kind of inputs. So I don't have time, but I mean, it's very interesting. So the visual inputs, that's called visual inputs. The internal motion, or the internal estimation of the position, that's called path integration. So it's very interesting to. So it's supposed to be done in another cortical region, which is called the medial entorhinal cortex, which projects to the hippocampus. And then you have a projection back here. So it's very interesting. And it's supposed to be grid cells, but I have no time. So the model we have at the end is essentially this one. I'm using exactly the model I showed you, this sizing model with these multiple maps encoded in the interaction matrix. And then I have inputs, which correspond to visual inputs or the internal path integration of locomotion, of the motion of the legs of the animal. And this input will project to the different maps, and that in the IC model is encoded by different fields, which depends on the position of the animal. Okay, so I don't have time to explain this, but essentially what is going on is that there is a conflict between when the light, so if we are before the switch, everything is nice. The integral, so the integration of the motion and the visual inputs are compatible. So we have a nice bump of activity in map A, and this is scattered in map B. Then you switch light condition to B. So now visual inputs tells the animal that you should be in B, but obviously nothing has been changed in terms of integration of motion. This is totally continuous. So the integration of motion says that, well, just go, I mean, a continuous way from the position where you were. Okay, so there is a conflict, and this conflict creates exactly an instability which jumps from one map to the other. But at some point, what will happen is that the internal model for the motion will reset and adapt to the external inputs. Because then there is a way, I mean, you have to solve this conflict in some way, okay? Conflicts are not acceptable, you know, so. And so we do a very simple two-state model for this path integration inputs here. So it's just a binary variable, A or B. And I can show you the simulation, and then we stop here. So here is the model. So the red cross is the position of a rat. We have taken the one in the experiment, so it's a plausible trajectory. And otherwise, what you see are the centers of the placebo of the neurons, which are active, and they are put at their position in A or in B, which are coming from the experimental data also. And here, what you see is that essentially the bump can be either well-formed in B or in A. So it's well-formed in A at the beginning. Maybe I can play it again. So at the beginning, it's well-formed in, well, sorry, I can't play it. So it's well-formed in A at the beginning. You see, it's, then you have a light switch. So you see this oscillation. It goes to B and then to A again. And you see this oscillation here until it will stabilize because the path integrator will reset. OK, so let me finish. So this model can make some predictions, and I have no time to talk about. One prediction I want to say is that it predicts that there should be an encoding opposition which is very good, but with a small loss during this conflict phase. And this small loss is not something just random. It's due to the fact that some input projects onto the right, onto the place cells corresponding to the right physical position, but in the other map. So that means that we do something which seems a little bit stupid. We just decode the activity with the wrong map. But this thing is very bad, but it captures the cells which actually are good in this wrong map. And you see again clearly during this conflict phase, which indicates clearly that there is a presence of a mixed state. So two bumps, there is a big bump, another one, a small bump in the wrong map. And they are in conflict. Okay, so we stop here. So conclusion, so I think we just provide indirect evidence for attractor neural network theory with multiple continuous attractors. It's very indirect. Okay. But the question is how these things, how the multiple source of inputs are integrated, and how mismatch between different these sources are, all these sources are resolved. So I think these are all interesting questions. There are many things which are missing. Of course, from the experiment point of view, if we could have joint recording of the path integrator and the hippocampus, that would be wonderful. So we hope to get this data at some point. We have to convince people to do that. There are a lot of things also which are missing. And there are biological questions in the beginning, but actually they have very interesting theoretical implications. I think one thing which is totally overlooked in the theory is the trade-off between the number of maps which can be stored and the spatial resolution of a map. And that's certainly something which is very important. And this is completely overlooked. There is no theory about that. And probably this is highly related, deeply related to the kind of connectivity pattern. And so there are data about that now, and it would be very interesting to do the theory and compare to the data. So I will stop here. Thank you.
What's the plastic element you have in mind when, if you have this conflict for path integration, like you say eventually the conflict is resolved, like what changes? Like how do you resolve that?
So there are a few experiments in the medial entorhinal cortex here, in the grid cells. So I have no time to present that. But there is another region in the brain, which is this medial entorhinal cortex, which is supposed to be the support of the path integration. And essentially there, again, there are some continuous attractors. And the resetting of the path integrator corresponds to a transition also from one manifold to another one. So this has been studied very little experimentally, but there are some evidence. There is a paper by Finn and collaborators, 2007, where they see when there is a global remapping in CA3 that there is a shift in the MEG.
So in some sense, conceptually, it's analogous to the switch in the part you were talking about for visual inputs, but for path integration, it's a similar simple switch, but in a different
part of the brain. Yes, and our hypothesis is that this is due to the feedback from the hippocampus to the path integrator, which tells him that's not good. It's not in adequation with the sensory input. You have to change.
So I'm not the expert, but I think your model is have a single hidden layer. Is it no?
There is no hidden layer. It's just a recurrent network.
Okay, but you don't have the hierarchical structure of J that governs another.
No, not at all. Again, it's not a deep network. It's a very shallow network. Call it as you want. There is no hidden layer. It's just a network with connection between the neurons, which seems to be the case anatomically. I mean, CA3.
I see.
Yeah. There is no hierarchical structure, nothing. I mean, this region projects onto other regions and so on. I mean, then you have connection between regions. But where people think that there is this memory, that's some kind of, you know, complicated pattern of connections with no spatial structure.
So I'm not sure that this is different from what you said, but if you put both sets of lights on at the same time, so you're trying to excite both minima for this.
Yes.
What happens to the poor rat?
Okay, so to my knowledge, this was not done in the experiment. So, but something was done, which is not what you're saying. But I mean, what was done is that they did continuous morphing. Instead of having a switch, you can go continuously from one light condition to the other one. So what you see in the data when you do the analysis is the kind of things where it's very stable at the beginning, and then we have a region where you can see this flickering, okay? And then at some point it will stabilize with the other. So there are these two attractors, and you have this region of, you know, it takes a few seconds to go through this region. So it depends on the loading rate, if you want. It depends on the rate. But so it can be very sharp or it can be very slow. But we can see this region of indecision, and then it will stabilize to the true extremity. So if you put the two together, my guess is that it will go on forever. It will just switch back and forth.
But why doesn't it build a third network?
If you do it for a long time.
It would learn that.
Yeah, sure.
So there's a competition between the third and each of those two.
Yeah. So people were, conscious in an experiment to test that and to measure the activity for a short time compared to the training time you would expect, which is maybe 10 minutes or something like that. So you train the rat, you measure this thing, and then you leave it in normal condition, and then you do it again. But you are right. If you do it for a long time, then it will maybe merge the representation and do something in between. Absolutely, which is very likely. Yeah. We will learn it as a normal environment.
So this is somewhat in line with what Sid is saying. Suppose, you know, in these experiments, you had basically just two conflicting options, A or B. And so, you know, there was the flickering between the two. So, but what would happen if you had a situation where there were three? Like, you know, the third state is both on and, I mean, then is this going to be sort of a situation where the flickering state is a decision between three, where it's looking at the over, or is there sort of a sequential? I will sort say whether it's A or, you know, or whether does it go through it? I cannot decide whether it's A or B, and then I cannot decide whether it's B or C. I mean, then the moment you have more options, then there is a path that leads to sort of.
Yes. So in the model, I can tell you in the model, clearly there will be competition between all of them. We have tried with three, and you see competition between all of them.
But now, are these pairwise competitions that get resolved, or is it like a tournament, or is it sort of, you know, all three are, you know, competing until?
Oh, okay. So we have tried.
I'm not even sure whether it makes.
No, we have tried in the spontaneous case. So not with inputs, okay? So, or let's say with fixed inputs, which are, let's say, more or less similar between the three. But now you would imagine a model with three states for the path integration and so on. So we have not tried that. But in fact, we can think about many kind of experiments which can be done in virtual reality. You can test all these kind of inputs. It's a very nice setting to do that. So virtual reality has also a problem. It doesn't have vestibular inputs because, you know, integration of acceleration because the rat is fixed. So there is one missing input. So it's not perfect, but it's interesting to test many ideas.
Okay, are there other questions? If not, we thank Jaime.